Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries daily, worldwide, over the Internet. For more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, business, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on quantitative easing when we come back. You know, under the terms of a contract called the Old Covenant, which was negotiated by Moses out of Mount Sinai, you and I are entitled to 33 articulable benefits. These are benefits such as rain in due season, multiplied gold, silver, herds, flocks, and great wealth. Well, our former president, George Bush, said that what Americans wanted was jobs, jobs, jobs. But you know, that's not what George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Ben Franklin, Moses, or God had in mind when they wrote our Constitution, wrote our Bill of Rights, and wrote the Ten Commandments. All of these authorities recognized that real wealth is measured in land, cattle, property, gold, silver, wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. It's not and never has been measured in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's because there's no money in employment. The money is in private business. The money is in sales. The money is not in public businesses, and it's not in jobs, jobs, jobs. And that's why I contend that it's time that you and I cash in on our inheritance and learn how to collect those benefits of the Old Covenant contract in gold, in silver, in wheat, corn, beans, honey, and oil. That's called real property, instead of credit, debt, usury, inflation, and more worthless paper. Now, if you'd like to learn how to do just that, why don't you call for more information on our compact disc homeschool for adults, and while you're at it, order our free general law CD package at the same time. It's a four-hour commentary on the law in general. It doesn't cost anything. It's informative, it's entertaining, it's educational, and it's free of charge. And you can call and order one right now. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Just click on to the archives page and then download that free general law CD package right there. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Go to the archives. Hey, we're talking about quantitative easing. That's a euphemism. That's a buzzword. It's a spin. It's a lie. Quantitative easing is inflation. And there's an inflation tax that we have to pay when we get into inflation. And if you've got a 401k, today's inflation tax is 7% of the purchasing power of the money that you're putting into your 401k. It's worse than that. It's worse than that. It takes that 7% right off the top. Let's suppose you've got $100,000 in your account. And let's suppose that the price of hillbilly bread today is $1 a loaf. Well, then based upon what you have already saved, what you've produced, what you've created, what you have saved, is 100,000 loaves of hillbilly bread. Okay. Now let's raise prices from $1 a loaf to $1.07 a loaf. 7% increase in price of bread. And you know what happens to you? You lose 7,000 loaves of bread. 7,000 loaves. That's 7% of your entire stash. Next year you're going to lose 7% again. And next year it's going to be 7% of 93,000 loaves. Now, let me just plug in 93,000 here for you, times 0.07. You're going to lose 6,510 loaves, plus 7,000 loaves this year. In 24 months, you've lost 13,510 loaves. And what did you get for that? That's your inflation tax. Now, government knows when they create money out of thin air, they're not producing any loaves of bread to put on the counter. And price inflation drives your savings down, and it drives prices up. Now, there's a counterbalance to that, and the Creator, you know, God Almighty, said, dig the gold and silver out of the hills, use just weights and balances, don't use usury and interest, don't use paper money. Said that in Leviticus 19, 35 and 36, Deuteronomy 25, verses 13 through 16. Now, we took a look at that, and we said, now, God, you know, you're a nice guy, and we love you like a brother, but, hey, listen, when it comes to economics, you know, you're kind of a dunderhead, and we're smarter than you are because we went to college, and we have a degree in economics. So we went out in 1913 over here in this country, and we created a Federal Reserve System, and then we created paper money. We went through a depression. We've been through inflations and deflations and so on for about 100 years. Now, started in 1913. We're in 2010. We're 97 years into the game, and we're on the verge of economic collapse, which is exactly where we were in 1783, on the verge of economic collapse, which is exactly where we were in 1930, on the verge of economic collapse. It isn't something new. We've been through this before. But you'd think that after going through this three times, you know, we'd sit here and say, hey, wait a minute, you know, enough's enough. When I was a kid, and you did something that was wrong, and your dad caught you at it, he'd grab you, throw you into the wall, and you'd beat the living hell out of you. I can't ever remember a kid doing that twice. I don't know if we were super smart back in those days, but let me tell you, after your old man got through with you, if you went out and did the same thing twice, you'd have to be suffering from the terminal stupids to do that twice. Well, especially if you got caught twice. Oh, my God. And then he not only would whip you for doing it, he'd whip you for being that stupid. Now, we Americans over here, we've been through this inflation, deflation, paper money, economic collapse thing, you know, often enough, it would seem. Let's see, we did this in 1754, 1783. And then we did it in 1836. 1866, 1873, 1893, 1907, 1921, 1929, 29, then we did it again as kind of a minor one in 47, 58, we did it again. 1971 through about 1979, 80, 81, long in there, about a 10-year one. Did it again in 1992. Did it again in 2001. Now we're repeating the same thing over again. And you'd think with all that much experience in economics, you know, that we Americans would sit here and say, you know, I think we've had enough of this paper. We haven't. Now, we've done gold. We did gold from 1787 to 1933. In the process, we became the wealthiest, most powerful nation in the world. You Englishmen over there did it for about 300 years. And when you did, you became the world's number one industrial, commercial, military power for about 300 years, 1600 to 1900. I mean, you know, from the defeat of the Spanish Armada until about 1900, you Englishmen out there, you were top dogs in the world using gold and silver coin. I would say if we looked at history at the use of gold and silver, when the Romans did it, they became the world's number one empire. When they turned away from it, Gibbons said they collapsed. It was one of the five causes of the collapse of the Roman Empire in 476 AD. There's enough history out there to tell us the answer to the riddle. Now, when gold comes into the economy, when it comes in as money, it comes in by labor. You have to work to go out and dig it out of the ground. So it's a commodity that comes into the marketplace with labor, just like lumber comes into the marketplace by labor. Now, when we use fiat currency, it comes into the marketplace by fiat. We just create it. The guy that creates it makes 100 cents on the dollar. For the rest of us downstream, there are no comparable goods or services on the shelf. You see, every ounce of gold that comes into the economy is a commodity that goes onto the shelf and is equal to all other commodities. When paper money comes into the marketplace, it comes into the marketplace and it buys up the commodities on the shelf, but it isn't a commodity itself, and it drives the commodities out of the marketplace. Now, that's what the bottom line of that is. Now, when I was a kid, to give you an illustration, the way the system worked was this. There was a creek up in Northern California. It was in Northern Mendocino County. It's on the coast about 16 miles north of Fort Bragg, and it's called Wages Creek. And back at the turn of the century, you know, from about 1850 to 1900, in that period of time, men could go up there and go to work in the woods, and they make about a dollar a day. Or you could go down on your claim on Wages Creek, and you could pan for gold, and you could make about a dollar a day. Now, some people like mining, and so they'd go out and they'd mine. They'd do the gold trick. And other people, they wanted to work in the mill, or in the woods, or in farming. You know, my great-granddad, he was a sheep raiser. Sheep and cattle. My granddad was, my great-grandfather was, and my granddad had the Needle Rock Ranch, which was in northern Mendocino County, up north of Wages Creek here, north of Westport. But anyway, the way this deal worked was the guy would work for a day and he'd get a dollar's worth of gold. Well, after about 20 days, he'd have about an ounce of gold, and by two or three or four months, you know, this guy would have some gold. Now, he'd take this gold down to the general store in Fort Bragg, and they had a gold scale down there, at least in 1944 when I was there, just a little kid, 5 years old. I remember that gold scale up there on the counter. Oh, there wasn't anybody using it anymore, but they used to use it in the old days, and they explained it to me. They said, well, that's where they weigh out their gold. And so they'd have this gold dust, you know, and then they'd weigh it out. You could buy, sell, and trade with the gold dust. Then the guy in the store who accumulated a bunch of it, let's say he's got 10, 15, 20 ounces, he'd get on a steamer. You know, this was before they had roads and railroads, 1900. The way you communicated or traveled was by steamboat. So he'd get on a steamer, and he'd go down to San Francisco, take it into the mint, and they would melt it down, asset, mint it into $20 gold, double eagles, and give it back to you. They charge you 1% to do that. So what happened here was the labor of the miner, the labor of the guy in the store, all working together, put that gold into the mint and into $20 double eagles that could be spent into the economy, and you could buy, sell, and trade with them. Now, conversely, if you didn't want to mine for gold, you could work in the mill, and you get about a dollar a day. Well, from time to time, they would produce too many boards. And then there wasn't as much need for lumber workers, and so they would cut your wages from $1 to 90 cents to 80 cents. But, you know, a guy, if he didn't want to take the pay cut, 90 or 80 cents an hour, he could go out there and mine for gold, and he'd get $1 a day. See? So if you didn't, well, I said an hour, if you wanted to work for 90 cents a day, you could, but you'd be losing a dime. Or 80 cents, you'd be losing 20 cents. Now, in 1900, $1 a day was about standard wages. Now, my granddad did both. He carried ties 12 hours a day, a quarter of a mile from land, out on a pier to a ship. And then he'd drop his railroad tie, and then he'd come back, pick up another one. He got paid $1 a day. You know, it's probably a little easier work if you're up there mining for gold, getting $1 a day. So when business in the mill dropped off, these guys would go to work mining gold. And then when gold got to be too much, well, then the price would go down. See, it's a commodity, just like labor, just like lumber, and so on. But it's always backed by the labor that it takes to create and produce it. It's a commodity that goes into the marketplace. Some people want to buy gold. Some people want to buy boards. Now, as time progresses along and there's a shortage of boards, maybe the mill would pay $1.10 a day. Well, now the guy that's working up here mining gold says, you know, I can make 10 cents a day more working in the mill. So he'd quit panning for gold and he'd go down and work in the mill. Now there would be a shortage of gold developed in the marketplace. And now they would pay something more for the gold. It fluctuates in value. If there's too much of it, it's worth less. If there's not enough of it, then it's worth more. Right now, you're in a gold bull market. There's not enough of it out there. It's been sold into the future 15 years. There's a physical shortage of physical gold. And some people know that, and they keep bidding the price up. Now, the fiat paper money guys come along into the game, and what they're doing is they persuaded us that we needed a central bank, and we bought into it. And now they're making this paper money. And as a result of that, they're able to create inflation, which is great for them because they create the money, go out into the marketplace, and buy the stuff. They get 100 cents on the dollar. Then by the time that filters through our society and there's a shortage of goods on the shelf because the government already bought them, now somebody has to go back and produce them, and so there's a temporary shortage, and so we raise the prices, like your hillbilly bread. And so the price goes up. And as these prices go up, these are taxes that we're paying. It's called the stealth tax. Everybody pays that one. I don't get away with it. I go buy a gallon of gas. When I was a kid, it was 30 cents a gallon. Now it's $2.30 a gallon. So, you know, inflation eats us up. Now, of course, if you're getting wage increases that equal or surpass the inflation like we did from 1918 to about 1975, that's great. But since 1973, boys and girls, we haven't had a pay increase. We are having pay decreases continuously. And now 10% of us are unemployed. And now the management in business has the whip hand. And boy, are they using it. They just used it. I told you about that union up there at the Mott Applesauce Company. Now, of course, the wage earners up there asked for that, you know. I mean, you got 10% unemployment, you got $20 an hour wages, and the management says cut it down to $18.50. They should have shut up and taken the $18.50. They didn't. They went out on strike, and so the management hired 300 scabs to take their place, and so now you've got the same number of unemployed. And what's happened here, though, is that the 300 employed are now unemployed, and the 300 unemployed are now employed. And the 300 that are now employed are working for $10 an hour instead of $18.50. And the management, that is the company, benefits. Yeah, you can sit there and piss and moan about the robber barons, but you know that's where the economic realities of life are. What I'd like to suggest is that we go back to the monetary system that God set up to start with, which was gold and silver, and it made America filthy rich in about 113 years. By 1900, we were the number one dogs in the world using gold and silver. You know, robber barons and marketplace and free economy, and we were number one. Yeah, it had some drawbacks because we had paper money at the same time. That paper money is the drawback. If you'd get rid of that paper money, you'd have wealth and prosperity. But we just can't divorce ourselves from paper. You know that? We never have. And any thought that you're going to now is, I think, is premature. But listen, those of us that deal in gold and silver, we're prospering and we're not complaining at all. I can tell you here at the Gordon House, we're not unemployed and we're not crying to the government. We're not taking unemployment, Social Security. And hey, we're not taking welfare, food stamps, or handouts. We're working full-time, happiest clams at high tide, and we're doing it all in gold and silver coin. And that's what God mandated. I would suggest that you give it a thought. You don't have to do it. Just, you know, think about it. Now, I closed yesterday, and I said we're going to take a look at this thing of how not to advocate a gold standard. It's written by Paul Nathan. Now, there's a guy that wrote a book on gold. It's called Pieces of Eight. Pieces of Eight. His name is Vieira, Edwin Vieira. If you can get a hold of that, that's the godfather of gold and the advocate of gold. It's put out by the Sound Dollar Committee, and They're strong advocates of gold and silver. Our forefathers were. They wrote it right into our Constitution. And I would suggest that you think about it. Don't have to do it, but think about it, because it produced wealth and prosperity to everybody that's done it for the last 5,000 years. I can't think of any exceptions. If you can, write me a letter. Tell me how gold and silver bankrupted people, would you? Show me how that worked. Now, many advocates of gold will argue that there is an official price of gold. It's kind of a fetish, official price. That an official price of gold is both necessary and desirable. This position accepts the premise of opponents of the gold standard, that legal tender laws should be established allowing governments to legally fix and regulate the value of money. Now, the free market position rejects this premise. It holds that the medium of exchange should be market-originated and market-regulated, not government-originated and not government-regulated. This means that the value of money should be determined on the free market, not dictated by government decree. Now, in our Constitution, our founding fathers gave government, that is the Congress, the power to set the value of money. Well, when you do that, it creates a monopoly. That's all. And you don't need to do that. You don't need to come in here and set an official price for George Gordon's cows. My cows sell in the marketplace. I don't have any complaints about the prices that I'm getting for my cows. My neighbors complain about the prices that they're getting paid in paper down here at the sale barn. And they cry to government and they say, do something for us. I'm selling my cows and I don't go to the sale barn, and I'm getting good prices for my cows and I'm not complaining, and my customers aren't. They don't complain about the prices that they're paying, and I ain't complaining about the prices that I'm receiving. And I get paid in gold. I'm telling you, boys and girls, when God set up this program now, he knew what he was doing, and he did a hell of a good job at it. Now, we have come into the game, and we've decided that God didn't know what he was talking about, so we set up a Federal Reserve. We've got constitutions. We've got money. We got money gurus and economists out here, and they're dictating to us. We've got a Federal Reserve guy over here, you know, Ben Bernanke. And we've got government bailouts and TARP plans. And, you know, you just name it, and we've got it. And I'm sitting here saying, hell, I'm not involved in any of that, and I'm happy as a clam at high tide. Think about that. So at this point, the official price advocate usually says, but if the price of gold isn't fixed, then no one will know what money is worth. And in the sense of having precise prior knowledge of gold's exchange value, this is true. Just as it is true for any other commodity exchange values. You know, I don't know what my cow is worth until I put her up in the marketplace. And then I say to the marketplace, well, here's what I want for my cow. Now, if somebody comes along and says, I'll pay that price, then that tells me what the cow's worth. Something more than I asked. Now, when I put the cow up for sale and nobody buys her, then I know the price is too high. So then I lower the price. See, I want to get all that the cow is worth. I want to find another buyer out there that agrees with me as to what my value is. But if I don't find that, let's go back to the Mott Company. The union said, our labor is worth $20 an hour plus. And the company said, no, it's worth $10 an hour, but we will pay you $18.50. And the union said, no. So the company said, fine, and they went out and hired the labor for $10 an hour, and they saved $8.50. Now, there's a downside to that. And the guy that runs the company, the CEO, he didn't deny it. He said, we have a workforce now for half price, but that's all they're worth because they don't know how to run the machines and they don't know how to run the plant. So we're going to have to train those people how to run this plant. So for a while, it's going to have some a slowdown in production and one thing and another. But ultimately, those workers will learn how to do that. Now, the union worker said, hey, we're a skilled, trained workforce. Yeah, but, you know, you got to go out into the marketplace, and if you say your cow is worth $5,000, and the customer's out there saying, no, I think she's worth $4,500, you know, okay, so you got to take it in the shorts for the $500. But the next cycle around, the next time you have some cows, there may be fewer buyers. And then if there's fewer buyers, you know, or there may be more buyers, depends. And the more buyers there are, then the less, then the more the thing is worth, they're bidding the price up. If there are fewer buyers, which is where you're at now in the economy, you don't have very many people out there buying. So that being the case, then you might have to lower your price. And so that's a marketplace decision. And remember that in the free marketplace, we accept the decision of the free marketplace. Conversely, I might produce fewer cows or less milk. Now, it's interesting to note that those who argue both that gold should be fixed in value and that gold is a constant store of value hold a contradictory position in which one claim offsets the other. If gold is already a constant store of value, then why should its price be fixed? And if it's necessary and desirable to fix the price of gold, then how can it be argued that gold has an intrinsically constant value? You know, you need not fix that which is constant, and that which one does fix cannot be defined as constant. Such inconsistency pervades this pro-gold literature today. In fact, what is being advocated is that gold should be a fixed yardstick, a constant store of value, evidently fixed by Congress, by government directive, rather than a stable store of value by market directive. Government determination to fix the purchasing power of the monetary unit ignores, in fact, it even contradicts, and it denies the law of the free market. Under a gold standard in which all nations deal in weights of gold, exchange rates would necessarily be fixed by relative weight, not by law. No formal international monetary system would be necessary, and no nation would be forced into or prevented from using other money such as silver, paper, and so forth. A gold standard does not require exchange rates fixed by law. It assumes only that exchange rates will be fixed as a result of adherence to the definition of money. And this means that if a monetary unit is defined as 1 ounce of gold, it will necessarily exchange for other monetary units defined in gold at a precise ratio. Unless the monetary unit is debased and is misrepresented. Now that's why we Americans have a dollar, a silver dollar, that weighs 371.25 grains of 3/9 fine silver. You see, it should be 480 grains. Philip of Spain debased his pieces of eight, his silver dollars. And when the Americans adopted the Spanish mill, the dollar, as the unit of measure here in the United States, it only contained 371.25 grains, so it's short 108 grains. Now our new dollars that are put out by our mint today are 480 grains of 3/9 fine silver. That's exactly correct. That's where it should be. And our $50 gold eagles are exactly 1 full ounce of gold. They're not over and they're not under. That's exactly correct. But our old $20 double eagles only had 96.5% gold, and what that represented was 3.5% short of an ounce of gold, and then they filled it in with copper. You know, that's a ripoff. Governments have been doing that from time immemorial, but it's a theft, just like inflating the currency is a theft. You know, somebody ought to come along and say, thou shalt not steal. Let's adhere to the Ten Commandments. An ounce of gold should be an ounce of gold, not 96.5%. And a dollar should be 480 grains of fine silver. In the marketplace today, we don't have any problems figuring that out. When a customer comes in here and I say, I need 4.5 ounces of gold for my class, we don't do business in dollars, we do business in ounces. We can all figure out what 4.5 ounces is. We can figure out, you know, how many grains are in an ounce of silver and what that silver will buy and how many ounces of silver you need. I can do it and so can you. So those who argue for an official price of gold can only hurt the case for a free market and therefore a gold standard. Price controls contradict a free market and therefore should be avoided. This includes control of all prices, including the price of money, the price of bread, the price of gasoline. Price controls have always been counterproductive and self-defeating. Worse, they establish the principle of government-provided security at the expense of individual freedom. To argue that an official price of gold is necessary and desirable is to argue that the free market doesn't work. And let me give you a reminder here, boys and girls, that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. We're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective, not state schools and all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school. It is open to individuals, but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc, and the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has our radio log schedule and archives, and all of it can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order one by calling the Law School and asking for it. The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, go to our website, georgegordon.org, click onto the archives page, and you can download that free general law CD package right there. That's georgegordon.org. Then go to the archives page. All right, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program, and we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements, these recommendations that we give, that doesn't mean that the author or the publication that we're endorsing are necessarily going to reciprocate. Keep in mind that most of these authors and publications that we cite here, they may be, they don't have to be, but they may be hostile. They may be political. They could be religious. Sometimes they're economic. Sometimes they're sectarian. They can be racial. Sometimes they're ethnic partisans. And their viewpoints may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review either. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program, they're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org, or you can go direct to our telephone line. It's 417 273-4967. All right, we're talking about quantitative easing. Quantitative easing, that's a buzzword. That's a spin word for inflation. And it kind of works like adultery. You know, you don't say to some girl, hey, would you like to go commit adultery with me tonight? You say, hey, would you like to do a little fooling around or go honky-tonking? It's going to lead to the same thing, but it's a little more polite, isn't it? You know, and so you don't say to somebody, hey, let's steal that guy's battery. We use a euphemism like, hey, let's boost that guy's battery. We'll just borrow it. We'll just boost it. We'll, you know, it all amounts to the same thing, doesn't it? We're going to take his battery, and he's going to end up with no battery, and we're going to end up with his battery, and that's called theft. And we're thieves. Now, government is a professional theft institution. Government steals regularly. They steal through inflation. That's their number one theft modality. They do it in many other ways also, but this inflation is number one theft modality. And so when we deal in gold and silver coin, they can't steal from us. That's why they hate it. That's why they don't want it. Same thing with banks. You see, people are complaining about how the banks are taking advantage of people on their credit cards, how they're being crafty and sneaky and cheat. They don't post your payments, and then they charge you for overdrafts and things like that. I'm one of the few guys in the country. I'm not complaining about any banks. Not a one. I'm not complaining about their mortgage policies. I'm not complaining about their bailouts and their TARP programs. I'm not complaining. I don't do business with the banks. I don't do business with the U.S. government. I don't do business with the mafia. I don't do business with the Cosa Nostra. I'm not complaining about the mafia. You know, they got to make a living, you know, like everybody else. But because of the way they make their living, I've decided not to participate. Now, our government has institutions like the CIA and the FBI and the Department of Transportation. Now, the Department of Transportation is a good one. See, they took over, along with Homeland Security, they took over the airplanes, the airlines. I used to fly on airplanes all the time. I spent $30,000 a year in Federal Reserve Note dollars. I spent $30,000 a year buying airplane tickets so that I could go out and talk to people, you know, like I do now over the air, but I used to do that direct. People would send me a ticket, and I'd get on the airplane, and I'd run out there to Kansas City or Lansing, Michigan or Atlanta, Georgia or New York City or wherever in the country you wanted to listen to me, I'd come out there and talk to you. And then the government got involved in it. And now, you know, the government says they want me to go through this machine, that they want to x-ray me. They want to see my secret parts. And I can understand that. You know, they want me to take off my shoes, bend over, take my pants down so they can look up my anus, and I'm bashful. And I won't do that. So the airlines lose about $30,000 a year in business from me because of that program that they have. That impacts upon you people in Hawaii. You know that? And that's because about the only logical way to get to Hawaii is to fly on an airplane, and I won't do that. You ain't looking up my hiney. So now you people that work in the hotels and you people over there that rent cars and do all those kind of things over there, you got one less customer. And I suppose you can sit there and say, well, to hell with you, you're just one customer. But no, it's not like that. There's thousands of people like me, and it's costing you millions and millions and maybe even billions of dollars of lost business. I'm spending my money. I'm just not spending it in Hawaii. I'm not spending it on a Carnival cruise. I'm not spending it down at Disneyland. So, you know, come on, let's wake up and smell the coffee here. Government programs, whether it be TARP or whatever, these policies that are being followed, these monetary policies, they have impacts. And in some cases, the monetary policy impacts upon people, and they like it. And then it impacts upon people like me, and I don't like it. And I influence the marketplace just like everybody else. And so I buy things or I don't buy things based upon what I think of the marketplace. And that's my point. You know, if we have a free marketplace, then we have, you know, you can come in here and you can choose whether you want to buy my cow or not. But, you know, the insurance companies, they went to the government and they said, we want you to pass a law and require everybody to buy our product insurance. And so now you have compulsory insurance. Pretty shortly, you're going to have compulsory health insurance, and you've already got compulsory auto insurance. Well, my God, boys and girls, can't they then compel you to buy compulsory life insurance and compulsory this kind of insurance and that kind of insurance and so on? I mean, what's the limit? If government can compel you to buy insurance, can't they compel you to buy television sets or carpet for your floors? Where is this going to end? When do we get the government out and let the marketplace decide? I don't know whether you should buy one of my cows or not. I don't know whether you should buy one of my schools or not. That's a marketplace decision that you make. I offer my cow for sale, and I tell you that I want gold coin for the cow. And I imagine that marketplace decision is made in the minds of many people that say, well, that guy's a lunatic. Well, I'll write him a check or pay him in U.S. dollars, but by God, I ain't going to pay him in gold, silver, or Russian rubles. Well, what if I said, I want you to pay me in Russian rubles? And you might sit there and say, well, by God, I ain't paying you in Russian rubles. Well, I lost a sale. You know, if too many people said that, I'd say, you know, maybe I better get off this Russian ruble thing, and maybe I better start taking something else. I mean, I could figure that out. Now, here's what I've learned over the years. People don't have any objection to paying me in gold or silver coin. None. I have never yet met a person who said, I will not pay you in gold. they asked me, where in the hell am I going to get gold? I don't even know how to do that. And I said, well, that's part of your education. Let me show you. It's very simple. I'll show you how to buy and sell and trade gold. I'll show you how to deal in just weights and balances, stop stealing from people, and stop paying taxes here, you know. These taxes that we're paying, especially income tax and Social Security, those are voluntary taxes that you sign up for. You've got a contract for those two taxes. Now, you don't have a tax for gasoline. That's a direct tax. But these excise taxes are voluntary. You don't have to sign up if you don't want to. But after you've signed up, you know, you've got a duty, don't you? It's kind of like joining the NAACP, or you're going to join the NRA or something. You've signed up. You agreed to pay the dues. Well, now don't you owe the dues? I mean, you can't have the benefits of the NAACP without paying the dues, can you? But you don't have to sign up with the NAACP. That's my point. See, it's voluntary. Now, that's what I'm suggesting here with gold and silver, and that's what this author is doing. Now, remember, this is from Kitco, about a 7-8-page article here on gold and the marketplace. And it's very valuable to each and every one of us that wants to practice this Ten Commandment model and get off this income tax and Social Security. Get off this government-mandated health care. Now, listen, the government passed this health care program, and 71% of the people here in Missouri voted against it. We had a special referendum, you know, during the primary season. I mean, the people here in Missouri, that's a big majority. 71% said, Obama, take your health care and shove it where there's no daylight. It's going to make the difference in the upcoming election this fall. Robin Carnahan is running against another guy here in our state, and she's a Democrat. And this guy she's running against, he slips my mind right now. I can see his picture right in front of me. She's advertising against him. He's Mr. Washington. He's going to win. He's opposed to the government health care program, and she's for it, and that's going to defeat her in this state. That's going to do her in. Now, listen, I'm not complaining about the national health care program. I'm not going to participate in it. You know, I'm outside of the national health care system. I don't have a Social Security number. You have to have a Social Security number to get free health care. To get government health care, you've got to have a Social Security number. Did you know 14 million of us don't have Social Security numbers? It's voluntary. You don't have to have one of those if you don't want it. Now, of course, I understand most of you people want Social Security, and I'm not suggesting that you give it up. But if you have a Social Security number, you need to sit down and shut up and pay your Medicare tax. You know, you need to sign up for government health care. That's what the agreement calls for. That's what Title 42, Section 301 through 335 mandates. You signed up for it, by God, do it. I don't have any objection to that. But if you've got an objection to that and you want to go back to the marketplace and free economics and supply and demand, you know, these crazy old-timey economic principles that come from the Ten Commandment model of economics, you could do that. And that's why we come on the air and we tell people about that. You know, there's an alternative to this. You don't have to be unemployed. You don't have to be out here working for the Mott applesauce company. I'm not working for the Mott applesauce company. I'm not complaining about their wage scales, and I'm not complaining about their Robert Barron CEO getting $6 million a year. God love him. I hope next year he makes 12. You know, I don't care. I buy Mott applesauce, but as long as I've got a choice to buy somebody else's applesauce, you know, if he can compete in the marketplace, I'll do it. Now, I've got my own apples, and I've got my own apple trees, and I can make my own applesauce, and if it ever gets to the point where I think that they're gouging me or charging me too much, I'll just quit, just like I did with the airlines. I just quit. Listen, boys and girls, I can get from here to there. I can get anywhere I want to. And if I wanted to get to Hawaii, I think I could get there. But by God, I ain't going on an airliner. You guys are going to starve to death waiting for me. Now, that's what we're talking about here when we're talking about quantitative ease, and government has got into the marketplace, and they've screwed up our economy. Now, the argument that there must be and or should be a major devaluation of the dollar is an offshoot of the official price argument. It accepts all the premises of that argument and therefore makes the same mistakes. But there are further implications of this argument that we should examine. First, devaluation means a return to a monetary system of fixed exchange rates at a time when inflation makes it impossible to fix the value of anything, let alone the value of money. Now, Bretton Woods, that was the 1944 agreement on money and policy. Bretton Woods is an eloquent example of what happens given fixed exchange rates together with inflationary policies. It's not good enough to say, well, we shouldn't have inflation. Fixed exchange rates would work if government stopped printing money and adhered to the value of the monetary unit. That's exactly what I told you. See, as long as we go out and dig the gold out of the ground and then go down to the mint and put it into circulation by labor, there'll never be any inflation, not a dime's worth. And that's why God told us to use gold and silver. You see, you can't inflate it. You know, it takes the same amount of labor today to dig an ounce of gold out of the ground as it did when Adam and Eve were bumping around in the garden. Same amount of labor. And there's going to be some sweat dripping off the end of your nose by the time you get an ounce of gold out of the ground. And it's going to be worth every ounce that you dug out. And that's the value of gold and silver. Because, see, once these bankers convince us that they should have the monopoly to manufacture our money and set the prices of it through Congress, they got the police power to do that, hey, they're in control. They've taken over the economy. They can rape us, rob us, and pillage us, and there's nothing we can do about it until we go back to gold and silver. Until you and I, individually, our families, I'm the only family here in this county, to my knowledge, working off of a gold standard. By God, I ain't complaining about nothing. I'm just doing great, having a great time. And I'm not paying into the Social Security program or the income tax program, and I'm not paying into the new Obamacare program. And by saving all that money and concentrating on my own business and concentrating on this thing of property, the holy grail of Anglo-Saxon administration, now let's get off of this price-fixing crap, and let's get down here back to the free market. Now, the second, the devaluation argument delegates to the International Monetary Fund, that's the IMF, the power to establish an international monetary system by law. Implicit in the devaluation argument is acceptance of the unfounded assumption over the decades that's been offered by this International Monetary Fund that this time the devaluation and exchange rate realignment will be final. Boys and girls, they've never been final. Those guys, after they tell you it's been finally lied to you, and then they'll say, hey, this is the new exchange rate. They're going to come back, they're going to give you new color money and tell you, hey, this new color money over here, hey, it won't inflate. And if you believe that, I got a bridge to sell you. I've been doing that for thousands of years. Come on, let's wake up and smell the coffee. Human nature is predicated upon these five motivators. It's vanity, jealousy, lust, greed, and fear. Notice that greed, greed, greed. You can't take greed out of the senator or the representative. He's got it, you've got it, I've got it. We've all got greed. Now, when we adhere to the gold standard that God gave us, hey, we have to go out and work to produce the gold to put it into the marketplace to buy the cow. We can't inflate it. But as soon as we say, okay, God, now you take your gold and stuff it, and we're gonna go back to money and paper money and cut a fat hog in the back. Well, okay. Okay. It worked good from 1918 to about 1970. And then in 1970, it broke down. And it's never been the same since, and they've patched it up, and now we're back to square one. The thing is on the verge of collapse, and it will. It'll collapse, and it's going to cause a lot of weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth. Many advocates of a gold standard unwittingly accept this assumption and thus believe that the way to achieve a gold standard is through fixed exchange rates and a major devaluation, which would reestablish a convertible gold dollar. This, they believe, is the way to eliminate inflation. It won't, hasn't in the past, isn't now, and won't in the future. But, in fact, just the opposite is true. It is not a gold standard that will lead to the elimination of inflation. It is the elimination of inflation that will lead to a gold standard. To attempt to maintain an international gold standard through the International Monetary Fund is impossible, given today's political context. We would only end up going off gold again, with gold getting the blame for the resulting crisis. That's why the paper money people, see, they point to gold and they say, that's why we had the last depression in 1930. It was the fault of gold, and we saved you from gold. No, no. Gold wasn't the problem. It was the paper. That's the problem. That was the paper was the problem in 1836, 43, 66, 73. You know, 93, it's always been paper is the problem. But the powers that be, they don't want gold, they want paper, and so they blame it on gold. See? Now, let me tell you again, I'm dealing in gold, I'm on a gold standard, my family operates on the gold standard, we don't have any complaints, I'm not complaining about Bank of America, I'm not complaining about the government, Obamacare, Social Security, income tax, the FBI, the IRS, I'm not complaining about any of them. Mafia, Cosa Nostra. You're going to find out, boys and girls, when you quit doing business with these criminals and these thieves, your life will turn around, and you won't have nearly the problems. And I can't even think of any problems that I'm suffering from here. Now, allow individuals to use gold as money, and an international gold standard will naturally evolve when and only when government monetary policy becomes non-inflationary. Until then, gold and exchange rates at national levels, at national monies, should be left free to seek their own levels. Fixed exchange rates will never and should never result from a formal international organization such as the IMF. These are bankers who are working for their own benefit, not yours. The stability of exchange rates will be the result, not of government price fixing, but of non-inflationary adherence to the value of money. For example, the elimination of legal sanctions that permit any government agency or bank or individual to deal in money and to buy, sell, and trade it freely in the marketplace. Now, as soon as you leave the marketplace alone, now see, you can come in here and you can buy a cow. You can deal with Krugerrands, maple leaves, U.S. gold. You can come in here with gold out of the creek and buy a cow here. We can do that. But we don't do business in dollars. Isn't that strange? You say, well, how many dollars do you want for that cow? I don't know. I don't deal in dollars. I don't deal in escudos or rubles. I don't deal in pesos. We just deal in ounces of gold. Or you could come in here and you could say, well, I'd like to trade you that horse for that cow. Well, bring your horse. You know, let me see. Does it include the saddle and the bridle and blanket? You know, is that horse broke? Or is it a wild stud, you know, from the range of Nevada? I don't know. you know, a Tennessee Trotter, you know, might be worth more than a wild Mustang. So bring your horse over and let's take a look at it, and we'll see what we can come up with. That's what business is all about. That's what the free marketplace is all about. Now, is your labor worth $20 an hour, you union people at the Mott Company? Can you sell your labor for $20 an hour anywhere else in your community? If you can't, then your labor isn't worth $20 an hour, and it was artificially boosted to that $20 an hour by price fixing through the union. That's a monopoly. And now, when you union people have to compete out in the free marketplace against the unemployed people, you can't compete. So, you know, you need to come up with a little different plan. You got to come up with a better program than that. That's what that bottom line is all about. Now, remember this article. Now, it's a long article here that explains the use of gold and why it is that price fixing is bad for us and the free market is good for us. Let the marketplace decide. Huh? Instead of government coming in, this is where Richard Nixon came in 1971. He said, we're gonna fix the economy by fixing prices. So he came in and he said, okay, you can't raise rents. We're going to have rent control. Well, as soon as he came in with rent control, that's good for the people that are already in the apartment. But it's really bad for the people that own the buildings or the people that want us to fix something, because at that moment in time, we're not going to fix anything. We can't raise the rents. We can never recoup what we pay out. So we're not going to paint your apartment. We're not going to put new carpet in it. So it's going to degenerate into a New York slum. That's the classic example, New York with rent control and the slums that it has developed. That's what price controls do. It disrupts the free market. If you leave the marketplace alone, it will resolve all of its own problems. Remember, this is Kitco.com, and you're looking for Paul Nathan, How Not to Advocate a Gold Standard. Hey, I'm out of time here again, boys and girls. We're going to have to leave it right there and remind you that you have been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review that were sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, around the world, in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now that's 8 schools in all. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. Oh my goodness. And over here on the next page here, let me remind you that all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Time's up. I've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.